That was wildlife management, Ken Ranch, from October 1945 until 2 years ago. That would be 1971, the 31st of December.
What responsibilities did you have?
Well, we were in charge of hunting and predator control and research. Did a lot of deer trapping, transport, and planting of deer in Turkey from here to other places. We had a number of graduate students that would come down and do research on the vegetation, animals, deer, and that sort of thing.
What predators did you find out there?
Coyotes and bobcats.
Those are the ones that are most...
Well, the coyotes were the most numerous. And probably were the worst enemy of our game species. We didn't bother the mountain lions. They were very scarce when I got here, and we made a point of not catching any of those. But we trapped coyotes very heavily. I would say that the first few years that I was here, we took over 2,000 a year. And then the numbers dropped down to about 4,000 a year. And finally, to fewer than that, we didn't try to exterminate the coyotes. We just tried to keep the populations at the level of where game would increase freely.
What about black cats? Have you ever seen any of those?
I've never seen any. I've heard stories about black cats, black panthers, and that sort of thing. They just aren't any, as far as I know. The leopard, I think, has some melanistic phases and probably some of the other cats, but we never trapped one here in all that time.
How about fishing?
Fishing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, fishing on the King Ranch is limited because we have relatively few lakes, and water levels fluctuate greatly because they're dependent on surface rainfall. On the Southern Cruise Division, there are, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. There are 5 or 6 fairly good-sized lakes that have fishing periodically. But then we'll hit a dry period, and the water levels will go down, and the fish die, eaten by birds, and that sort of thing. And we have to restock and start over. And the fish, freshwater fish potentials of the King Ranch are not very great.
How about things such as foliage and so forth? Do the deer tend to eat up quite a bit of foliage? Or?
Well, they do. We have data on all that sort of thing. I think deer on most of the areas that were studied, there are about 6 to 8 deer, the animal equivalent of one cow in this country. Of course, it would vary with the type of woody vegetation present. In other words, in the live oak country, it would be different than it is in mesquite acacia country. We had heavy deer populations at Norris. In fact, a deer to about 4 acres, as I remember, of a large area. In fact, we had one study area that had far more deer and turkey on it in over the late 40s than it had cattle. And under that condition, the deer did eradicate, or at least they tended to destroy some of the more important food plants, like lime prickly ash, for example. It's very rare there now, and it was quite common at the time I came. But there's an overlap on many of these food plants by cattle and deer, and of course those are the ones that suffer.
I noticed there's brushy places here and there on the ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Does that have a function?
Yes. The brush clearing began here in the early 50s on a substantial scale. And I have the data on how much brush was cleared a year and that sort of thing. If you'd like for me to get some papers will indicate that. I think per clearing was usually at the rate of about 35 to 55,000 acres a year. And we worked ahead of the bulldozers, marking out strips and mots and cover, woody cover around the periphery of these wetland ponds and along the drainage ways, and left it specifically for game. And under the early conditions of land clearing, game actually benefited from root flying because the openings were relatively small and the percentage of brush that was left was relatively great. In other words, we left many brush strips that were, say, a quarter of a mile wide. But as things went on, more and more brush was cleared. In other words, and some of the key brush was cleared. For example, we have two large lakes on the Sunny Trees Division, the Escondida and the Tronquitas. And in the early stages of brush clearing, we left all of the brush around those lakes and in the traps that enclosed them. And those traps were 1,500, 2,000 acres in size. We left it specifically for game. But as time went on, somebody would lose a cow in a brushy corner that we may have left for a turkey roost. So they'd bring the dozers in and clean that corner out. Or strips that were started out to be 200 yards wide, well, somebody would have trouble driving cattle down them, so they'd make them 100 yards wide, and then 50, and finally 30. So we lost our balance between brushy cover and improved roof flying, and I put improved in quotation marks. Country and the cattle and the game both congregated in the brush that was left, particularly during these wet periods like after Hurricane Bull, because that roof flying country is real boggy, see. And as a result, the really cover, the quality of it was gradually diminished, and the soil underneath the woody cover was trampled in wet periods and compacted to where it doesn't have the native vegetation, either quantity or quality that it had in the early time. This thing of striking when you're going to clear a country to improve it for cattle, you can do it and strike a balance between native vegetation and the cleared country that you should plant it in exotic grasses, and have a better condition for both game and cattle. So striking that balance is a difficult thing. The amount of brush you'd leave would vary with the soil type, it would vary with the topography of the country. In rolling country, you don't need as much woody cover to protect game as you do in flat country, because the game uses the topography itself as for protection. But if something, for example, if you went out here to leave the turkey roost in a pasture, you'd have to be able to recognize what types of vegetation turkeys prefer to roost in. They like to roost near water, they prefer hackberry mots to mesquite trees, and all those things would go into your planning for the brush program. But you can't say that if you have 10,000 acres, leave 1,000 acres in brush and make it in strips 50 yards wide, because that wouldn't apply in every place. Every pasture is an individual problem, and how much cover you leave in one pasture is affected by the condition of vegetation in the next pasture. If you know a landowner tends to graze his pasture carefully, you need more brush than if he grazes lightly or moderately. So it's a rather complex thing, and nobody yet has succeeded in laying out a specific formula any more than a doctor could write out what to do in case of heart attacks. It would be appropriate for every individual to have one.
When did the King Ranch start brush control and so forth?
Well, on a large scale, you would have to say in the 50s. Now, there was some clearing on the Wallace prior to that time. In the 30s, they cleared a lot of country and planted it in road grass.
But prior to that,
and there was farming here in the 20s around the Sun Tree's headquarters. But all of the early brush control was largely ineffective, except in instances where they planted grain or cotton or something else, which they did also in the early days. But the clearing that's been a big factor in affecting the game population, and adversely, it might indicate, things like deer, turkey, and javelina. That began in the 50s.
How about things like burning pears? Is there much of that done out there? Is the foliage thick enough that we don't need it?
No. The last cactus burning on a big scale was in the 50s, during the drought of the 50s. Now, cactus burning is a real good technique in cattle management, and it's done in places in the Grand Plain still, and will be in the future. But I would say that here we've had above average rainfall since Hurricane Beulah in 67, and there hadn't been this big need for cactus burning. Now, had I owned some of this country and it'd been my cattle, I would have burned some cactus since 67 for cattle on the King Ranch, because cactus is very high in vitamin A. And there are times when the cattle here have eaten the cactus with the thorns on it for short periods to get vitamin A. But they've gone the route with the burning grass they've had of mowing the grass and spraying it with molasses and everything else, trying to get the cattle to eat this old dead weathered grass. And burning pear under that condition would have been very useful from the standpoint of cattle nutrition.
What type of brush and so forth do you find out in King Ranch?
Well, right now you'd probably have to say that resatch is predominant. Before brush control, we had relatively low resatch, and it was mostly confined to the peripheries of wet weather pond. And this plowing the country has loosened the soil and actually made a moist environment through the first few years following root plowing. And weesatch is all over this country. In fact, it's a big problem how to get rid of the weesatch. In other words, you took a mixed brush association that consisted of predominantly mesquite in most of this country, and the secondary story was Groundhanna or Western Hackberry and Black Dash. There was a lot of wahia on parts of the King Range. I don't think you can find a plant there now. They're good range plants for livestock as well as game. But you had a mixed brush association. First they went in and changed a lot of country, and of course all that did was remove some of the big mesquites and allow the surviving mesquites to re-sprout, and allowed all of these secondary species to re-sprout. And then they went in and root plowed, and that killed mesquite quite effectively whenever it was done when soil moisture was deficient. Now, if there's a lot of moisture in the soil, it didn't even kill mesquite. But what it did do, root plowing on brushy species, it reduced the number of species in the brush environment. Invariably, you may have had 7 or 8 species that were fairly common, and it would reduce it to 2 or 3. And it increased resatch, and it increased prickly pear. Now, since then, a lot of the prickly pear died back. For years, we've had a lot of insect damage, and we've had loss of prickly pear over thousands of acres by a bacterium, and I'm trying to think of the name of it. Anyway, it was a disease that came in, and probably came in because cactus had been made much more numerous and abundant than it occurs in nature, almost a solid stand, and over thousands of acres. I probably couldn't even walk in there to eat what little grass there was.
in your book, Foreign Legions.
Forgotten Legions.
You write of sheep
mm-hmm.
in this country. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, of course, the Spaniards brought sheep in just like they brought cattle. As Dobie has said, the Spaniards brought all kinds of livestock wherever they went. The sheep that accompanied the early Spanish entradas were not the wool sheep, they were the mutton sheep, or churro sheep of Spain, and they were taken along mainly for food. They had sheep, the Spaniards did, at all of their mission outposts. It's always been interesting to me the fact that they brought sheep rather than cattle, because I think it tells us a lot about the early grass cover in this country. You've heard the popular concept that grass was waist high, a stirrup high on a horse, things like that, and I'm sure it was in certain situations at certain times. But sheep simply will not do well on tall grass. They're like deer. You put a deer in a pen, grass up to the neck of the deer, and they'll starve to death. A deer will eat short grass and farbs, and sheep the same way. So the very fact that the Spaniards brought in so many sheep is an indication to me that the vegetation in the grass particularly was not uniformly high throughout South Texas. Because if they'd done that, their sheep wouldn't have thrived, and they certainly did, especially on the Rio Grande River, vicinity of San Antonio and other places, Mission San Juan Bautista near El Paso. So the Spaniards brought the sheep. Okay, then we had the war between the U.S. and Mexico. And I'm sure that all types of livestock partnered declined in that period. Then you had the war between U.S. and Mexico, which was a further detriment to development of the livestock industry in South Texas. But after the war, and we'll say when did it end, 1848 or along in there, when the so-called Nueces Strip, the territory between just north of us and the Rio Grande, became a part of the United States officially, and then you had the ranchers moved in with livestock, and again they brought many sheep. And sheep were already important as a factor in the vegetation in South Texas and in the economy of the region by the time of the Civil War, and they increased thereafter. And for fully 30 years, from the 1870s until the mid-1890s, there were many more sheep and goats than there were cattle in South Texas, contrary to popular opinion. At least the censuses showed more, and the tax rolls showed more. So you either have to conclude that there were more sheep here than there were cattle, or you have to conclude that the sheepmen were a lot more honest about paying taxes than the cowmen were. So I think there were more sheep. I don't think there's any question about it. And of course, we documented that in this book to seemingly to everyone's satisfaction. Except the people who seem to think that, they've been known as big cow men for many, many years. Superstition that goats with sheep would tend had disease in sheep. Of course, that was just an old wives' tale, but they believed it, and they had a few goats to run with the sheep, but not many, just a few. The goat herd normally was kept separately from the sheep, and it was simply the staple meat supply on the ranches.
How did sheep do in the brush? Did they do well?
Well, when the sheep industry was at its height, in the 1880s, there wasn't nearly as much brush as there is now. You see, there was less brush in early times due to the continuous and reoccurring fire. Whenever this country got dry enough to burn, it burned, if not for one reason or another. Man, lightning, what have you. That naturally tended to keep down the brush. But when they put so many head of livestock in here that they didn't have the fuel to carry the prairie fires, when the brush increased and spread into the openings, just as it did in many other parts of the United States. I think it was in Wisconsin that the people talk about moving into the prairie, and then a few years later the oak trees were 12 feet high, etc. Well, they couldn't grow that fast. But they'd been burned down and sprouts come from the woods. But fire is a part of the natural ecology of this country, just like rain, sunshine, and all the rest. A lot of people don't realize that, and they tend to condemn fire. And the Smoky Bear thing that first started with the Forest Service and then was adopted by the SCS in their relations with range people during the period of World War II, to my notion, has been a big detriment to livestock management in Texas. A fire properly managed and controlled, in other words, you might call it prescribed burning, is a very necessary tool in keeping down woody vegetation all the way from here to Florida. And it's being so used, incidentally, in the Southeast, and has been for many years. They burn most of those pine forests now annually, or at least once every 2 years.
What diseases do you find in ranch management, wildlife management, and so forth?
Well, by and large, disease is not an important factor in a healthy wildlife population. Disease comes in when animals are malnourished or overcrowded, and of course, it's a secondary thing. I don't say that animals are free of disease. I think, for example, in the early days, that disease or parasites were probably a factor in keeping the bison out of this country, more or less. There are many records of bison, of course, from, say, the Balcones escarpment north and westward. There are relatively few records of the occurrence of the bison south of the Balcones escarpment. The early intriders and the early settlers in their journals do remark about seeing a few bison, usually in the vicinity of San Marcos or over in that country. And they'll say, well, we killed 5 bison today, one of which was fit to eat. The rest were very poor and covered with ticks. Well, that leads me to believe that the bison, which would come and drift in here periodically ahead of a very cold winter in the Panhandle and Hill Country, and would have small reason for going elsewhere with the grass being good and all that sort of thing, were probably adversely affected by the fever tick, because, you see, the fever tick didn't overwinter in this country. It didn't overwinter north of here, it did overwinter here. And our longhorn cattle took it north, of course, but it caused a lot of problems with northern cattle. But I would say that the fever tick was probably the reason that the bison didn't occur in larger numbers in South Texas and more generally over the area than they did. Of course, hot weather in summer was probably a factor too. The screwworm was probably a factor too. But a lot of those things they're so poorly documented in early times, and we have a lot of research on a lot of things, but on things like where the screw worm came from, when it first appeared, how severe it was in early times, we just don't have the record.
Do you think that the ticks hurt or hindered other animals besides bison, cattle, and so forth?
Well, the fever tick is not supposed to reproduce on deer. That is the Australian fever tick. Now, the South American and Central American fever tick does reproduce on deer. And I just can't say, you remember Stephen F. Austin's colony over on the Brazos River, 1 year game was so scarce, and the deer were so poor that they ate their horses. And something must have been affecting the deer population then, because they wouldn't have been that poor, and they wouldn't have been covered with ticks. But as I say, you can take any herd of cattle in this country, or a herd of deer, or say a covey of quail. The fact that they're in a group doesn't mean that they all are either fat or almost fat or poor. It's like a concentration camp. Everybody didn't starve to death in German concentration camps. You had some people who were still in pretty good shape, and some that were skinny, and some that were dying and did die. And it's the same way the nutritional level of animals in any one group. You have weak individuals, and on those weak individuals, there must be a change in their blood chemistry, because they invariably, your external parasites and internal parasites too will increase as the animal gets in poor condition. In other words, if you want to see whether ticks are abundant on deer, and you see five deer standing out there, and you see the reds on one, kill that deer, and then you'll have more ticks than the rest will. So I just don't know, but the things go together. Now, really, no parasite should kill the host, because it dies too. But there is a correlation between the physical condition of the animal and the amount of parasitism.
Mr. Newman, thank you very much.
Well, I don't know whether I gave you much that you can use, but...